Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Doubters on Thursday, the 19th of November. And our guest today is joining us from Canada. I should say Calgary, Alberta, to be a bit more specific. So Mark Iturriaga, is that the correct pronunciation of your name?
It is. Very well done, yes.
Oh, that's good.
It's Spanish, so it's easy to pronounce because the I's, every letter sounds the same, so it's the I's are just pronounced E's, so it's Iturriaga, so perfect.
Oh, that's great. Anybody, I'm very bad at pronunciations, so it's good. I'm glad I got that right. So Mark is joining us today as our guest from Calgary, as I said, in Canada. Very welcome. So let me just introduce a little bit about what this is, and then we'll get onto the conversation today. So this is The Doubters. This is my private online community, a place where we aim to embrace self-doubt as a route to meaningful and sustainable growth. And the reason I've created this community is to really explore what that means and to provide a space to support people doing that, because, and myself doing that, in fact, because it's not an easy task. Our topic today is not belonging is the new belonging. I'll explain what that means in a minute. But just to say, we have a few people joined us here live. You're very welcome. It's great to see you here. What we'll do, you feel free to contribute throughout the conversations in the chat window. Mark and I I'll introduce him in a minute, and then we'll get on with this conversation. And then at about 20 to the hour, I'll open up and you can feel free to come in and ask any questions or make any contributions at that point. You're very welcome. If you want to join in but you don't want to come on a recording, we will close off at about 10 to the hour, and we will just have a little free-for-all space then, and you can just feel free to just hang around, and whatever comes out. I think that's all I need to say. So welcome, Mark. Let me introduce you and this topic, what this is all about. So Mark Iturriaga is a well, I call you a diversity consultant, and you on your LinkedIn profile have called yourself a belonging crusader, which actually sounds much more exciting, dynamic than a diversity consultant. But I think you probably, like most people, wear many hats, and that may come out. And so I like to introduce people through my connection with them. And Mark and I really, we just connected on LinkedIn. We have a very similar purpose, a very shared aim around our work. And we just connected on there, and we've connected, and you've supported my work, and you've been interested in what I'm doing, I've been interested in what you're doing. Like I say, there's a lot of synergy in what we're doing. So it's great to have this conversation with you today. Is there anything you want people to know about you by way of introduction, Mark?
Well, when you talk about the diversity aspect, diversity, equity, and inclusion is a very big concept, and it's an important concept. And there's a lot of scholarly work around it, and discussion and theory. And that's why I kind of stayed away from that, because that's not my experience. I'm not a scholar of equity, diversity, inclusion. But what I liked about the belonging, and why I chose belonging and belonging crusaders, because that's the outcome of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I kind of frame it that way, like diversity is a reality, and then equity, inclusion are ways we manage to create an inclusive society, and belonging is what we feel. And so I like to think that I'm a crusader for that feeling, to help people get that feeling of belonging. So that's kind of, where I feel like I'm not an expert on belonging either, and I've explored many different ways, but that's really the passion I have. Though I know it lies in the diversity, equity, and inclusive landscape, belonging is really where my passion lies.
Yeah, I love the way you describe that, that belonging is the outcome that we're looking for. That's fantastic. I really love that. And I just want to say a little something about you. You say you're not an expert, you're not a scholar. And I think by its very nature, that diversity is you can't have an expert at diversity. We all come with our very individual aspects to that. And I think that's what makes it such a beautiful landscape and arena to work in. And it's by its very nature that, we should welcome everybody to bring their little piece of what they can offer into this. And I think that's the beautiful thing about it. But I recognize you're coming with an element of humility there in saying, hey, I'm not an expert, I'm just doing my thing. And, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons that I love talking with you about this stuff, is because you do come from very much from that perspective. So let me just introduce a little bit about this topic and why, you know, we are having this conversation today specifically. So not belonging is the new belonging. It's a bit of a catchy title, but really what this is that, belonging is such a fundamental human desire. We all have it. And I think I don't know anybody that's not struggled with feeling like they belong somewhere. And it becomes even more difficult, I think, even as we become ever more connected, I think it probably becomes even more difficult. And there's a really big relationship with self-doubt, because we find ourselves in these areas where we're not belonging, and then we often turn that on ourselves. What am I doing wrong? What do I need to do? How do I make myself belong in this environment? And, you know, for me, it often comes out of, what have I done wrong? What am I doing wrong? You know, that's often how it manifests. I'd be interested to hear if anybody kind of experiences that, but it manifests in a different way. I don't know. So belonging is really important. But also, you know, where I like to think the not belonging is the new belonging, why we're having this conversation here, is because if we can learn to tolerate that space a little bit more of being in self-doubt or being in not belonging, is what can that bring us? And that can bring us a different perspective on life. It can bring us a different perspective on a group. It can help us to really stay connected with our values and what's important to us, at the expense of trying to fit in. So that's really where I'm coming from it, because when we fit in, we are at risk of, compromising our values, and all sorts of mucky stuff can happen there. So the reason I'm talking to Mark about this today is because, you know, called yourself the Belonging Crusaders, because, Mark, what I love about the work that you're doing is that you openly admit that you come from a space of struggling with belonging yourself, and how you have addressed that and what you're doing with that, how you're tolerating that space more, is that you have created a big mission out of this. And your mission, so your way of creating a sense of belonging is to help other people find a sense of belonging. And you're working in the area of recreation, which I never really thought about before. I've got no knowledge of this area, but it's actually a really interesting area to work with around belonging. And I'm sure that will come out through our conversation. So I love the way that you've gone about, you know, your challenge of not belonging and how you've created this mission out of it. I think that's a really powerful example, and I'm just really happy to bring that example here today. So, Mark, perhaps we can just kick off this conversation there. Would you be happy just to share a little bit about your background and why this topic is so important to you?
Absolutely. What's interesting is, you know, Olivia had mentioned how we kind of just connected, just kind of shared passion. There was no intention of, I don't know what we could do for each other. We didn't know. It really started off with a conversation. And through that work, I had already started thinking and talking about belonging and what that would mean from a work standpoint of how I could take belonging and actualize it into some purposeful work. And through that, and working with Olivia, did a lot of reflection on why this was important to me. So Olivia was really critical to that reflective piece and connecting some of those dots. And so, you know, part of it was talking about where I came from as a child. And so my mother is French Canadian, and my father's a landed immigrant from Chile. And they both met in Toronto, and realizing that that's not a traditional matchup, where both my parents were English as a second language. They didn't speak English before they got here. So I grew up in a household of two different three languages. Didn't learn Spanish, and I didn't learn French through my parents. And I'll even start off with, you know, I identify purely as a straight, white, cisgendered, privileged male. You know, I come from that. Although in reflection,
so you should belong.
Well, exactly. True, right? I mean, all the pieces are there for me to belong. But then not really, you know, because you're living it, you don't realize it. I was surrounded by a lot of diversity, not intentionally by on my point. It just was my lived experience. And when we talk, you know, you talked about that scholarly piece, right, is that we all have experiences and that lived experience that we come with that often aren't valued by others because it doesn't fit into the narrative of society, of that white, straight, male, privileged world we live in. And so grew up in that environment. It wasn't until recently I realized that I was a first-generation college university student, which is often a narrative people use, but I didn't even realize it, you know, because I was privileged and grew up in that world. But my mother only finished grade 11 high school. She left after that, and so, but education and the work that they did. But having two parents growing up in this, I mean, traditional immigrant lifestyle. I would never have thought of that as my reality, but it was true. I mean, they had struggles and in hindsight, I could see that. I skipped a grade. So I was always the youngest, as a boy too. Boys tend to mature later than girls. So I was that much further from my peers at school. So I can remember still watching cartoons and doing the traditional boy things when the rest of my classmates were experimenting with smoking and kissing. So for me, it was
grown up stuff.
Yeah, and I was okay with that. I was told by my parents that, you know, I was very comfortable talking with adults at, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old and could gravitate to that. I'm short. I'm 5'6". And though, again, in reflection, I've never seen how that might have affected my experiences. But in a white male dominant world, you know, I've seen that height and that, you know, that masculinity of, you know, of being tall. I've never actualized that as any effect. But now in hindsight, I can see where you know, and it helps me understand where other lived experiences come from that may not be able to understand that. So from there, you know, I lived my life, and I've always had friends, and I've always had experiences that I never felt I was left out. But I never felt like I truly belonged, in the sense that I read comic books, for example. I still read comic books. And that's an activity that I've only done with myself. It was something that I found and I enjoyed, to the point that at university, I used to go to the comic store once a week, and it was like an hour walk from campus, and it was my time I would go, and everyone would wonder where I was going. And I'd keep the comic books under my bed, and it wasn't to hide it from anyone. It just was, it wasn't something I needed to do with other people. And I just, you know, it was what I did. And so where I saw many other people would gravitate to, oh, let's find other people that read comic books, or I played basketball, let's find other people that play basketball. That wasn't my reality. And so what that did was make it difficult for me to fit in. And what I saw that even in university, I would gravitate to people that were unlike me. I didn't want to find other people that were into comic books or into basketball. I was intrigued to the point that I failed. Now, remember, I skipped a grade, and I've always, the joke in my family is that, you remember when you used to be gifted? because I used to go to a special school once a week and all that. And in first year university, add to that, I had such high grades in high school. I could have picked any university or any. I didn't pick a university that other friends went to. I just went to a school I hadn't even seen it with the purpose of, because the program I was in was actuarial science. So just to give you a background there, I'm in belonging in sport and rec and student development. And I started off in actuarial science, which is the mathematics of insurance. I don't know if, you know, anything further apart from an experience there. And so in first year university, I spent more time hanging out and just listening to different groups in my residence on campus that I actually failed 4 out of 9 classes in my first year. And I wasn't of age, so I wasn't drinking. I wasn't out partying or doing anything. It was strictly staying up late, being involved with all these different people that I was just kind of soaking in their lived experiences to try to, but I wasn't trying to fit in either. And so when I looked at, even to the point that when we had to move out of residence and start renting houses around, I was going into houses with people I had no clue, where other people, oh, Olivia, you want to rent a house together? We'll do that experience. I just jumped in and jumped in another house of people I didn't know. The weird part is I'm not an extrovert. I'm not someone who, Olivia and I, we talked about this. I don't like parties. I don't big group gatherings. I'd rather have an intimate conversation. But then my experience, so I really saw myself trying to, I don't know if it was to be a jack of all trades of people and just kind of learning about these lived experiences. And then again, in reflection, I see that where my parents divorced. My father married someone from the Philippines. My uncle, he's a Syrian Muslim. I have French-Canadian relatives that I didn't really speak with because I didn't speak French. I had Spanish relatives in Chile that I didn't speak with because I didn't have that traditional, again, grandparents and aunts and uncles. We were a very tight-knit family that way. Growing up, my best friend was Black, and I spent a lot of time with his family where oftentimes I was the only white individual in the group and watching. But it never, ever felt not normal. It just was experience. Even working when I graduated, so I ended up going from actuarial science to general arts, where I took everything. I continue to take physics and chemistry, but then I took psychology and children's literature and Roman history, and I graduated with a degree that many would argue is worthless. But also from there, that's when I started with sport and rec, because as a student, I didn't need to work as a student. I wasn't a struggling student to say I need to work or else I can't go. But I worked every job. I worked in residence life. I worked in athletics. I worked at the student center. That's what I just did. And from those experiences, that's where I started to find my calling and my passion. And so that started off with students and working with students and student development. So from there, I worked in youth programs where we worked across Canada. I worked in Ecuador for 4 months in a rural community in Canada. We're working with Ecuadorian participants and Canadian participants. My first five bosses were either women or LGBTQ identified. And again, it wasn't something that I sought out or even noticed at the time, but I understand that I had the opportunity and the privilege to have those experiences and really learn from a diverse group of people in my life. And that's really what set me off on the journey up until this point. When I think about belonging, again, I never really felt like in any of those situations I actually belong. But I also didn't feel like I had to work to fit in. And so when I reflect on all of that and why it's, and you helped me realize this, that because I didn't belong, I often sought out and looked for those who also didn't belong and try to, and I realized by understanding and learning other people's lived experiences, I can be that facilitator because I can bridge that understanding of why certain life choices or certain realities and experiences, I felt like I could be that bridge to say, do you understand what it really means to have this experience, to come from this background or to feel a certain way? Because that's where I really felt my purpose was. And though I didn't actually understand it all the time, over the last couple of years, that's really where my focus comes. And then when we talk about belonging itself, the great part is that as I've reflected and talked with organizations that I consult with, there's often this feeling like, oh, are we doing something bad? And I feel like I say, no, over the last 2 years, this is all I've been thinking about is belonging. So when we talk about, that expertise, or it's not necessarily that, I think anyone could do this. It's just that that's where I put my energies, where other people have, well, I have to think about this and that. And that's absolutely the reality of where we live. And so, and it almost comes back. That's why we have things like consultants and that, because you, Olivia, you are in the realm of self-doubt, and you think about it a lot, and you're writing about it.
I certainly do.
Right. And so that becomes your passion.
Yeah.
And people feel the passion, and then they want to, you know, hear more about it and learn. And it's all a journey. And that's, again, with belonging, I think it's a journey for everyone. And part of that, I think, and we've talked about this, that starts with that self-actualization and comfort in your own skin.
Yeah.
If I know who I am, because we talk about, can I be my authentic self? Well, some people don't know who their authentic self is because they've done so much, put so much energy into trying to fit in that actually know who they are or what they actually believe. And they start mimicking and you kind of, they kind of lose that self-identity. They've given up themselves to fit in.
Well, and that's the actual risk that we're trying to avoid, right? By this, you know, what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. But let me just reflect upon what you shared there. Thank you for going so deeply into everything. And as you talk about that, I think about, and you talk about your lived experience of growing up around such a diverse environment, I feel such a richness around that. And it's in complete contrast to the environment I grew up in, can I just say, because my family for generations, I've said this before, come from one town in the northeast of England. and we moved away from there in the 70s because it became quite deprived, the area. But at one time it was a big shipbuilding town, you know. And I grew up in a family in an area where it was all white. I grew up in a family of five older brothers. So I just grew up around white men, basically. it's just a complete contrast there. You know, I grew up in a monoculture, essentially, and you grew up in that complete diversity. And obviously, if you're talking about it now, you're talking about stuff with the benefit of hindsight and being able to reflect back and look upon that. And as you say, you're talking about really not belonging, being your familiarity. You know, that was the place that you were familiar and almost, I'm not sure. Well, I guess the question I want to ask is, was it comfortable at any point? Was that painful for you? At any point did you talked about not feeling like you had to work to fit in, but at any point, you know, was that painful for you? Or did it cause you to doubt yourself, essentially?
I don't think it was ever painful, but I think it comes back to the thoughts that you shared about self-doubt is what was I, if it was harder for me to listen or understand, it came back to what was I doing wrong? What did I do different? And I realized every time I tried hard to fit in, and move away from that place of authenticity, meaning that instead of being in an experience and actually just absorbing the experience and appreciating the experience for what it was, whether I felt uncomfortable or not, when I did that, I realized I learned, I grew, I flourished, and I felt comfortable. When I tried too hard and observed and tried to really push myself into a situation, that's when I found myself even more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say it was ever painful in the sense that, I ever was extremely depressed. I've been lucky. I'm not a depressive guy. Sometimes I get bouts of a depression over a day or two, but I haven't understood or experienced that severe depression or pain because I felt lonely. And in fact, I've had experiences where I spent time with myself quite a lot. I worked in a rural area where I didn't know anybody. And for about 4 months, I spent 4 months living with myself and by myself, after having lived with so many different people and experiences. When I was in university, I always lived with 5+ people, always, you know, whether it was in a residence or, and so that was a great experience for me. Felt pain, but it was when we talked about that uncomfortableness, it's when I forced trying to fit in is when I felt the most uncomfortable.
Okay, yeah. So what I'm hearing you saying, it sounds to me like that you had a connection with yourself where you were able to connect with what felt comfortable and what felt uncomfortable for you and allowed that to guide you almost. I think a great measure of how comfortable we are in our own skin is how much time we can spend by ourselves, like, you know, without feeling lonely and feeling comfortable in our own skin, you know. Mm-hmm. So it feels like that felt like a guide for you, that kind of measure of comfort. It didn't sound like you were willing to compromise that.
I don't know if I was I didn't also feel the need to share that with others. I was comfortable doing it, right? Just kind of like some activities. I just did it. And it was, I dwelled on.
Never questioned it. Never doubted yourself around that.
well, on that part, when I was alone, right, it was in those groups. And I think also later on in life, I realized that I'm not an extrovert. And think that I am. I can speak in front of 1,000 people and I can be wacky and energetic and people think, wow, he's this guy. And I'm not at all. You know, after doing that, I need a good nap. I need some time alone. You know, I recharge by being alone in small groups of people. And we've talked about this also in new groups. What happens is I'm an observer. I sit back for quite some time that people don't, after they get to know me and understand, they actually don't realize it. And then we'll talk about an shared orientation experience or, oh, remember when we first got together? And I'll say, that wasn't, you know, you didn't see me. Because in fact, I was the person sitting in the chair in the corner just watching and listening to people. And it wasn't, again, to fit in. It was just to kind of, again, observe and experience what people were thinking, doing, and acting. And I don't know what I did with that information necessarily, because it wasn't to be, oh, okay, I like that person, I'm going to go experience them. It was just really taking in the environment and seeing, and possibly now in reflection, is how can I be that bridge between certain areas? Because I was always so along with everyone, but also I only had few very close friends and a lot of acquaintances, but no one that I felt like I would open up to. And then that's always been my feeling, and I'm comfortable with that. But even right now, experiences, especially in that white male environment where we're not to share our feelings and that, that's even harder to find.
Is that still going on?
Yeah, it's still going on. Even to the point where we have discussions with, I've reconnected with high school friends, and we do it through, you know, social media and texting. And we'll start diving a little deeper into our beliefs. And then it quickly goes into raunchy humor or sports.
Oh, yeah. Diversion tactics. Yeah.
And it's okay. But it's also, you know, that's where I tend to go, I don't need to be a part of that. And
Yeah. Because, this is the thing. You're deep, aren't you? And you like to talk about important stuff, you know, meaningful stuff. And, you know, as you're talking, I think that being the observer, I think, is a wonderful natural skill to have in a group, because so many times I think, you know, that kind of that essence of not belonging, and where I think, you know, perhaps where what that's brought you is the ability to do that. Perhaps I've just observed this because, you know, often what happens for me if I'm in that position of being in a new group is that I do sit back and observe, but I'm thinking I should be contributing. I should be, you know, telling a story here. Look how good they are at telling stories. Look how good they, you know, and my thoughts go completely to all that expectation. And that's why I think it's so uncomfortable for me. Whereas if I could just accept myself for being that person actually that isn't like that, you know, and that's okay. And then you come from a different position of like, well, what can I bring? You know, how can I be authentic in myself here? Do I even really want to be part of this group? You know, because often I don't. You know, so I just think it feels like a much more powerful position to come from.
Well, what's interesting is in our prior conversation of talking about this session is the idea that, you know, what I like about the belonging work isn't about the individual person. That's the outcome, the goal of helping an individual feel like they belong. But we talked about this idea of the system, right? And so when all the doubt that you're having, imagine how powerful it could be if society around us understood what you were going through and helped facilitated you to feel like you belong rather than onus on the individual. And we do that in society. We put the onus on the individual to navigate the system that's in place. And then so we talked about someone who's privileged, and they often don't question themselves. What do they do? They question the other person. Well, the system is perfect for me. And then the doubters and those that don't feel like they belong, they question themselves instead of questioning the system. And I'm starting to think that with this Black Lives Matter movement and this more inclusive revolution, that we are understand that we've been putting the blame on the victim in some in cases of saying, well, you should find a way to fit in, instead of us thinking, how do we change the system so that people have less self-doubt in that realm? I mean, when we've talked about self-doubt being a powerful influencer and a motivator and a tool, but how can the system facilitate belonging? And we don't, right? We say we've created it, and it's been created by, you know, white privileged straight men. And that's the challenge. We've talked about this idea of, well, we just should invite more people to the table. And again, the problem is that the table has been built by white privileged straight men. And we're asking people to fit into that setting, the etiquette, the culture, whatever that looks, the conversation. And so when we look at diversity, equity, inclusion checklist, and that's because we're asking diversity to come to this table and almost say, shut up and fit in, as opposed to we should destroy that table completely and get who's involved to recreate that table so that they have a voice, so that they feel included, that they feel invited and welcomed. And that's really, I think, the challenge with belonging is, if we continually try to get people to fit in, then and we don't change our current systems, it's always going to come back on the participant to or the individual to say, one of them.
Yeah. And so this is why your work is really powerful, because you're actually working in the area of, you know, dismantling that table and creating something new. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in recreation, and actually also why it's specifically powerful and important in recreation?
Sure. I've worked in recreation and I fell into it. I'm not a sport and rec degree person. I'm not a coach. I was never an athlete. So it was just something I kind of fell into.
And short basketball player.
Well, yeah, exactly. Who never achieved anything. I don't have any award. I don't have any. I'm a good player. I'm okay. But I just really loved it, to the point where I was running leagues. I was playing and captaining several teams, but just for the pure love of playing and moving.
Yeah, and isn't that wonderful to be able to do that for the love of it, you know?
And that's the systemic problem right now.
Yes.
And the journey of sport and rec right now is there wants to be more inclusion, but again, they're unwilling to change the system. And when we talked earlier about outcomes, that's really what and any strategy and any purpose, I think of, well, what are you actually trying to achieve? And I've often come to head with many, you know, again, you talk about a lot of leaders that are privileged white men, is that their outcome is to continue to stay privileged. It's really what, you know, they'll say, well, we want this as long as it doesn't privilege, right? And that's why we have a lot of backlash and a lot of, you know, what you're seeing in the States with regards to the election is there's a fear of a group of losing that privilege that they've had for so long, not understanding that, you know, it's not about we're taking from you to give here. It's saying we're bringing up everyone to a point of inclusivity and equity. Mm-hmm. In sport, it's the same way. We have a lot of good intentioned individuals, but it's the system that's wrong. And so what I did was reflect on the successes that I had in sport and rec. And so the thing that I hang my hat on was, over a 5-year period at the university that I worked at, we increased program participation from 11,000 students a year to over 30,000 students a year. We didn't have a change in population or a change in demographics. And what I, in hindsight, what my team and I and everyone involved, we flipped the system where we focused on the people, the students, rather than the traditional system of sport and recreation. So an example,
which is actually quite elitist, isn't it? The traditional system, because you have to achieve and you have to, you know, if you're first, second or third, otherwise you're forgotten about. And
absolutely. And that's where, you know,
not getting involved because you love it.
Well, exactly. Because the outcome in organized sport isn't as much as they say. It's not about a healthy, active society. It's about developing elite athletes that can compete at a high level for, you know, country pride, for, you know, for success. And that's what we measure. And then they say, but because there's so many good benefits of sport, that everyone's feeling that, but they're not, because it's very elite. It's very a friend of mine coined the term systemic elimination, is that once you're not good enough, or you can't afford or have the resources to play, you don't meet the mold. So, you know, I could be as great, but I'm short. So my ability to be successful, you know, gets diminished. You know, you don't have the commitment, you don't have the time, resources, or it's just not your motivation to win. So, you know, you basically leave the system. But there's no other system in sport and recreation that really captures the other goals, which is, I just want to be healthy, I want to play, I want to create social connections. It doesn't matter if I'm developing my skills. I just want to go out and move and have fun. And we have that system. And so when we talk about sport and recreation, and when I'm working with those organizations, they need to understand that it's their system that's at fault right now. And what they reward, what they prioritize. And so there is no measurement of belonging. We don't ask participants when they leave why they left. And we make assumptions that, well, they just didn't like sport anymore. And it's like, I don't think that the sport that is being provided to them, because we haven't provided that system. And so I created a belonging framework, because I wanted to create it as accessible to practitioners, because one of the challenges with sport is you have these high level coaches and researchers, but then you also have the people that are just doing it. And or diversity, equity, inclusion is very heady to capture. And so for me, it's about how do we make that, and really breaking it down to three tenets is, how do we invite people into our spaces and opportunities? Once they're here, how do we welcome them, make them feel like they're comfortable, that they're accepted of who they are? And then how do we include them so that they feel like they could be lifelong participants, bringing their authentic selves where they don't feel like they have to fit in? And Sport and Rec has done a horrible job with that, because it's created, there's a sense of belonging, but only for those that already accept and are traditional in the traditional Sport and Rec culture.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you're talking about inviting them, accepting them, and including them. Is that right? The framework?
Welcoming. But I mean, accepting.
Welcoming.
Yeah, welcoming.
Welcoming. But, and making sure, making sure they feel accepted and welcoming. Yeah. It's so important, isn't it? And when I think about my experience of recreation specifically, that's not what I've experienced. It's being, you've got to be at a certain level, you know, you've got to be wearing the right thing, you've got to be, you know, paying your membership, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's
and so it works in in any area. You know, if you think of community access and development, right? Those tenants still belong. How are we inviting people within our communities? Even in a workplace, when you're a new staff member, how are you invited and welcome and included into the culture? Again, oftentimes we're looking for fit and finding people to fit into the culture or already have those, as opposed to appreciating the diversity and the authentic, you know, and asking people to show up to work authentic selves. We don't do that. Really say, well, they just weren't a good fit. And it's like, well, what were you valuing there, right? If you were valuing that they shared the same interests and jokes and the same mindset, well, then you're not really valuing diversity, because diversity is more than skin color. Diversity is more than culture and faith and sexual and gender identity. It's about attitudes and personalities and, you know, and that lived experience where that comes into play, that someone comes with a different lens to look at certain problems to help us grow.
Wonderful. So we have come up to the time. If anybody wants to come in and ask a question or make a contribution at this point, please feel free to do so. You can unmute yourselves and put your camera on if you want to. Mark and I will carry on chatting, so you can come in at any time. We'll just stop and allow you in, or if you don't want to come on the recording, we will stop in about 10 minutes anyway. But nobody's really unmuting themselves at the moment, Mark, which is fantastic. No problem. That's great, because I've got a question. So what strikes me is, you know, another reason why this is so important, this aspect is so important in recreation, is because, well, I look at sport in this country, particularly football is the, like, it's probably the national sport, probably was rugby at one point, but it's football now. And I look at the impact that football has had throughout my lifetime, particularly around racism, I mean, it's still a big problem in the game. Racism is still a big problem in the game. But when I grew up in this country, it was, I mean, you know, England in the 80s was a very racist country, and particularly where I grew up. And football, I think, more than anywhere else, has had an impact on bringing people together, bringing, you know, races together, but particularly black and white. There's a lot of very good black football players. And obviously, you know, football, and there's Formula One at the moment, which is doing a big job in, you know, representation and also bringing people together, or showing how to bring people together. So, you know, for me, it feels like a really important area to get this right and to get more people included.
Yeah. And my concern is that that's this much work when this much work needs to be happening, because I'll use Formula One as an example. That's an extremely privileged sport.
Oh, like, gosh, yeah.
You know, it's not like you can go from a, you know, an economically impacted community and oh, I'm going to be a Formula One driver one day, right? I mean, and so, again, it turns into more checklists of, okay, well, we have more diverse representation in our drivers or in our and they say, okay, well, we'll check that off, and now we're diverse. But that's not truly the case, because the system is still very exclusive. And if I look at football, it's the same practice. Is you're saying, oh yeah, what do we value there? We're valuing the athletic ability, and so then it's saying, well, if you're athletically talented, now we'll accept you.
Exactly.
Well, anybody should be able to play football for whatever motivations, and we should focus on that. But the money, the resources, the prioritization, and the way we measure success comes to that talent and that winning. And so one of the things I don't have data on this, but I often think about, is that sport is traditionally competitive. And so that's, we measure success by how much we win. And so that's a hard thing to navigate when that's not the only outcome. And again, when we talk about sport and rec and a healthy community and people that are active and moving their bodies, winning has nothing to do with that. And in fact, an elite athlete isn't necessarily healthy. They might have the physique.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So true, actually, isn't it?
Mentally,
it's not really a healthy lifestyle, is it?
No, it's not a healthy lifestyle. A lot of when people quit the game or aren't able to play the game at that elite level, there's a lot of mental health issues. I mean, there's dietary. You hear this about young professional athletes that live a life of junk food because they're traveling. You know, and so we have the idea that an elite athlete is healthy. And so our outcome is a healthy community. So let's make more elite athletes. That's almost, I know it's never said, but that's kind of what it feels like. Instead of how can I put money and resources into a community that plays and moves and has those benefits of sport, of bringing people together, but not valuing talent or physical ability, but this idea that here's a group of people coming to play, to be socially connected, to have some fun, right? And how healthy is that for a community? Yeah. And that leads to them feeling like they belong and developing sustainable lifelong habits that then is less on society, because you have less self-doubt, you have more confidence in the group, you have less health issues, you have, you know, all of these things come into play, but we don't prioritize any of that.
Yeah. Carol, did you want to come in? You put your camera on. Hey,
Mark.
Hi, Carol.
Okay. I have an analogy because I played basketball for a year. I'm very short as well, so I was never in the A team. I was always on the bench, and often I, with group of friends, I feel like I'm not in the A team. I'm, you know, I will not be invited or directly, and I always suffered from that, because I have lots of different groups of friends, but I'm never, well, a few I'm part of the A team. But because you have that diversity group of friends, you know, some people they have two friends and that's it. So they'll be part of that A team. But if you are interested, curious about different people, you end up never making it. There's part of suffering in that, because, it's really funny because, like, my daughters are suffering the same way, is that they have loads of friends, but they might not be necessarily invited, or it's, so you always suffer from this lack of yeah, belonging, sense, feeling of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
I
think that's very powerful, because one of the things I've been really reflecting on most recently is that power of invitation and how we all seem to sit back and wait to be invited, which is, I think, a natural experience. And so when we can look at our privilege and our influence and say, okay, I'm waiting to be invited. Who else is waiting to be invited? Can I be that invitation for someone in a realm? And I think that's what we do in society is we post information, right? So anything, right? Come to this. Here's the information. Here's the data, the info, where, why, how, the cost. We don't actually create any sense of feeling or any sense of why someone might want to come, because they feel like this is a place for them. And so it's hard, because with social media, with posters, with all, that's what we, because it's easy. It's easier to do that. But we know that that word of mouth and that personal connection, that personal invitation is so powerful, yet I'm not sure we do much intentionally to do that. And so the system, again, waits for, well, we put out the information, so that's our invitation, as opposed to saying, oh, Carol, you love basketball? Come play with us. Oh, I haven't played in such a long time. No, we're just going to go play. And to be able to address your concerns, your doubts, your stress, how can the system do that? And people can do that very easily, because if I know you and you're comfortable with me, that sense of belonging together, I can bring you along to create a larger sense of belonging. So I could probably convince you to play basketball again with a group of people that are doing it for fun and social connection. And again, you might go, but I can guarantee you, if I could get you back on the basketball court with just that feeling, I'm just going to have fun. We don't care about winning. We don't care about how good you are. We're just going to have fun and we're going to connect together. That I feel like I could convince you. It's going to take some work, but no amount of posters or information.
No, Mark, don't worry. I'll be convinced. It's just the invitation is not arriving.
Exactly.
I will come in.
And that's the challenge, I think. You're absolutely right. The invitations aren't coming. So how do we, as a society and within our systems, how can we be more focused on that invitation? Because the welcoming and including part is important, but I feel like that can't happen unless you actually get invited and feel like I can come. Because then once you're invited, then the experience takes over. And so if you show up and all of a sudden I'm yelling at you, oh, you didn't shoot that guy. Whoa, now you're, I don't feel welcome now. You're probably not going to feel like you belong. And so there's other parts and work that we need to do, but we're not even doing the first step of getting people to show up to do what they want to do, or maybe not even know what they want to do. So that invitation is very critical. And that's the work I know how to do that in a sport and rec framework, of because it really relates to a business strategy of recruitment and retention. So that's the language and the pain point that I can address with a system. We need more people, I need more revenue, and I need to keep them here. Great. Now let's talk about how you do that in a different way than what you're currently doing. But from a personal and altruistic point of view, is saying, how can I get people to come and just be and have fun? Again, how we're not doing those invitations, and we do it so poorly, and I'm not sure. And we know it doesn't, what we're doing doesn't work, but we're still stuck in doing it. And that's what I'm exploring more of, because I really want to know how to create those invitations.
I think that's such a powerful point, really, to bring out from this conversation. And just to touch on that a little bit, is that invitation is something that I've been exploring recently, but actually making an invitation can be a challenging thing to do from a personal point of view, because it also makes you vulnerable. If you think about I'm going to invite the whole class to my party, but what if nobody turns up? Mm-hmm. What if nobody turns up? And so it's about how to make that invitation and create that open space, but know that you're open yourself to vulnerability and being okay with that vulnerability, the doubt around it, that space of doubt that it might create, because it could be that nobody does want your invitation. Mm-hmm. Or they might not want it yet, this is something that's actually important to me, and I've been reflecting upon that, and I would like to bring more of that into my work, that invitation. So maybe we'll may have another conversation about this.
Well, it's interesting, because you're right that doubt creates you know, a universal doubt, and so then no one's doing it. And so,
if
everyone is doubting whether someone's going to accept my invitation in the way that it was meant, and actually show up, but when no one does, so it's better just to not do it at all.
Or when they don't show up, it's their fault.
Right. That's right. But yeah, could we do that? Yeah. But I also feel that our invitations sometimes aren't meaningful enough to the person we're giving it to. So you could say, hey, come to my party. And someone's going, I don't really know you. What are we going to do? Like, I don't know. I think you like this, and that's not the type of music I like. So there's probably self-doubt on their end, right?
Yeah.
So again, how can we have that? And I think that invitation needs to address that doubt.
Yes.
In our systems, is how do we curate that experience and facilitate the experience for an individual so that we alleviate their doubts, right? So we can tell them, well, here's what's going to happen when you show up. Here's what we're actually going to do. And, you know, yeah, it might be boring, but we're going to have nice food and drink, where you can help them. But we often say, would you like to come? Yes, no. And nothing there to it, right? And so there is that interpersonal connection and understanding of the person being invited, what their needs and doubts are, that we can walk through to get them to come.
It's brilliant.
Want to come.
we have come up to time, unfortunately, so we'll bring this to a close, but you don't need to go just yet. We can hang around for a bit because we can carry on the conversation. Just to say, Mark, just to hand it back to you, any final comments, and where can people find you, find out more about you?
So I have Bonobo Consulting. So it's bonobo-consulting.com. And
I put it in the
wonderful. And so Bonobo, the story behind that is that the bonobo monkey is one of the more social animals in the animal kingdom, where there's no necessarily hierarchy or people, or, you know, animals in the community that are excluded. And I think belonging also needs to be a little bit of fun, and that's where that comes from. But really from there, it's just about chatting, and I'd love to connect with anyone who's just interested in having a conversation about what belonging means, because it just fascinates me.
Lovely. Well, thank you for coming along today, Mark. And stick around. We'll close the recording off now, but we'll carry on the conversation afterwards. So just to say, next week, I'm going to do something a little bit different. For the next 3 weeks, I haven't got any guests coming along. What I'm doing instead is I'm making an invitation for people to come along, and we're going to create a space for reflection. After this challenging year, I think it's quite important. And how, you know, one of my definitions of self-doubt is about creating a space for hesitation and reflection. And we often find it really difficult to do this. It's a big challenge around self-doubt, creating that space, because we don't know what's going to come up, and we think we're not going to like what's going to come up. So I'm doing this little experiment for the next 3 weeks, a space for reflection. I invite anyone to join me, and we won't record it. I'll record my bit, but I won't record your bit. And I just invite you to come along, and let's see what comes out. So I'm going to turn off this recording now. Thank you to everyone who's joined us live here today, and for everyone who's listened to the recording, and I'll see you next week.